you make the point in your book that this isn't the story of a typical suburban kid who, you know, went amiss somewhere in their life. Do you feel that the press coverage gave the wrong impression of your daughter's story?
Absolutely. Nancy was mentally ill since birth, had had terrible problems through her whole life, and she was really no different at 15, 18, or 20 at the time of her murder than she was as a little girl.
Do you feel that you lost her story when she became famous and the press picked up on it?
Absolutely. I think that she was treated without any dignity. Nobody seemed, particularly in the press, to care what the real story was, that she had been a child from a family that had loved her, that she had spent a fifth of her life in school for mentally ill children. I think that they treated her almost as if she had somehow hatched from under a rock somewhere.
What were the signs when she was young that there was something wrong?
She came home from the hospital at the age of 9 days because she'd had some problems, had to stay a few extra days. And she didn't just cry. She screamed. She screamed night and she screamed day. And it was really a cry of pain or of anguish. And nothing seemed to quiet her. She never slept for periods of more than 2 hours. At the age of 4 or 5 months, when you went to cuddle her in your arms, she would stiffen her body and push against you and scream. She didn't like to be held. And it was just so very difficult to get her to do anything other than what she wanted to do. And yet each thing was an effort. When she got up in the morning, you couldn't get her to get dressed. She would cry. At the end of the day, you couldn't get her out of her clothes and into her pajamas. Each day was a battle.
And when she was an older child, she was very difficult in the house, too.
Yes, she really, after a while, manipulated everybody so that she, in effect, controlled the household. It just became easier for everybody, not to give in, per se, but to try not to antagonize her, to try to do things so that it would be easier, because once you set her off, it could be hours of screaming and throwing things and temper tantrums.
She used to use the most obscene curses on her whole family, including you, her parents. When she was, like, demanding on getting her way and would just curse everybody like crazy when she didn't, how did you figure out how to handle it, like when to give in and when to draw a firm line and not budge?
When she was younger and you could still control her physically in that you could pick her up and put her in her room and shut the door, it was easier to control her. As she got older, these particular episodes were accompanied often by a great deal of self-destructiveness. It was not unusual for her to take her fist and haul off and smash herself in the face, or perhaps to threaten, if you don't let me do this, I'll put my hands through the window. And when you turn your back, she'd do it. So that it got to the point where you really couldn't control her anymore, and you just tried to do your best to keep from confronting her and to set off a situation where you knew she would respond in this manner.
You sought professional help. What kind of advice did you get?
The first time we took her to a psychiatric clinic was at the age of 3 and a half. We had mentioned to pediatricians before that we felt there was a problem. They said, love her, channel her, guide her, she'll outgrow it. She's just very bright. When we took her to the first clinic, at the end of 6 months, they discharged us and said, if you have further problems, bring her back. We really got no useful advice, nor did we ever get a diagnosis nor a prognosis. I'd say that the cry in the first 10 or 12 years was always that, love her, channel her. I couldn't imagine what they thought we had been doing. And the rest of her life, when we took her to a doctor or had her committed to a hospital, they would say, you might as well take her home. She's much too sick. You've waited too long.
Must have made you very angry.
Yes. I don't know any mother that wouldn't feel angry. I think that the doctors were dishonest with us. It's only in the last 2 years when I had some of her medical reports or psychiatric reports released to us did I really find out that a number of doctors thought that she was quite ill mentally, that she was possibly a childhood schizophrenic, and there was also a possibility of a brain tumor, and that a neurological examination was indicated by doctors, but none of this information was ever relayed to us.
You think they were protecting you from the information?
I think partly they were protecting us. I think also it was a situation which is not much different today, the situation of here's a child who's very ill and probably will end either in a mental institution, in jail, or dead. And the doctors perhaps were frustrated by the fact that they could not offer us any concrete advice. I asked one doctor, she was about 11 at the time, what should we do? And he looked at me and he said, darned if I know. So I think they were frustrated because they had no doctor to refer us to. They had no hospital to refer us to and no hope.
When did your daughter start listening to rock music?
She always loved music from the time she was very little. Her father played the guitar, not professionally, just for fun, and she loved to listen to the music. There were always records around the house, and she listened to Broadway shows, anything that was music. But I think she really started to listen to rock music at about 9 or 10. She became the consummate Beatles fan. The show Hair, she wore out 2 records of the show. And from there on, her love was music, and she always was turned on by the music that was about to become the hit. If she bought a record, I know her brother and sister would always say, that's what's going to be, you know, the music in a year from now. She seemed to have this sensitivity to what was going to be the next important type of music.
Did she ever play?
She tried once to play the guitar. She took a few lessons, but she had a very poor motor visual deficiency, and I think she was frustrated by the eye-hand coordination, and she gave it up. She was really the observer.
When did you start hanging out with people who were in rock and roll bands?
That was, I think, at about 16 or 17, although when she went to school for disturbed children, she had a boyfriend who played in the band in the school. She didn't have the mobility then to go to concerts. It was only after she was out of school that she started to really go down and listen to every possible concert that she could.
She said things that led you to believe that she was maybe becoming a groupie. How did you handle the kind of typical, you know, mother-daughter facts of life type conversations, given what she was into?
I think that a lot of the groupie information did not really come to me until later, after her death. But there were I certainly knew that she was treading a very thin line, and there was a whole lot of her life that was secret, as many teenagers have, but I had that gut feeling that this was something different. And I did try to talk to her, but by that time, it was really very difficult to communicate with Nancy on any level.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Deborah Spungen, who's written a book about her life and the life of her daughter, Nancy. The book is called And I Don't Want to Live This Life. And how did you first become aware of her relationship with Sid Vicious?
Nancy had lived in New York for about a year and a half. And this was about 7 years ago. And most people had never heard of punk rock at that time. And she's at least alleged that she was friendly with the New York Dolls and the Ramones and Blondie, who's Debbie Harry. This was the beginning of the punk rock movement. And she seemed to get bored with that. She kept saying, the real music is in England now. It's in London. And she went off to England with the $500 that her great-grandfather had given each of his grandchildren as an inheritance. And she went off to England with an open-end ticket. And a few months later, I heard from her, and she said that she had met Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols. And as far as my husband and I and our children were concerned, we had never heard of him before, and we really didn't know who the Sex Pistols were.
What did you do to find out?
We kind of didn't do very much because we thought this was another one of Nancy's, you know, the new wave music, which it was, and that eventually we'd hear more about it. And if we also thought that, as in all her relationships, all of her life, that it would be a very brief and fleeting relationship. One of the manifestations of her mental illness, whatever you want to call it, was that she had a great inability to maintain a relationship with anybody, including siblings, peers. So we really didn't put too much stock in any of it, and just went on till we got the next pronouncement from Nancy.
Which was?
Which was that now they were married. And we found that very difficult to believe. I don't believe they ever were married, as far as I know. And by that time, the Sex Pistols had gotten a little more notoriety and publicity. and her younger brother and sister looked into it and reported back to us something about the music and what it was. But they insisted that it would probably become very popular because of Nancy seemed to have this feeling for what was going to be next in music.
At what point did you start reading about her in the newspapers? What was that like?
It was very upsetting. It seemed like this wasn't Nancy. It wasn't necessarily a feeling of shame, but it was kind of a distance. This was no longer at all the Nancy that I knew. I guess it was about a year after she was in England that a UPI story, I believe it was, had been picked up that she had been arrested with Sid Vicious. And the picture was in the paper. And because it said Huntington Valley, everybody, the press contacted us. And I suddenly was thrust into a situation that I had never thought I'd find myself in, of telling papers no comments and having to having people call me on the phone and receiving obscene letters and obscene calls and having the press knocking on my door to what to us seemed to be a very innocuous situation.
Yeah, it's really like every parent's nightmare, don't you think?
That absolutely.
That something's going to happen and they're going to become famous because their child has done something terrible or antisocial.
Absolutely. I mean, here we were, I guess, the ordinary people, you know, of the late 70s, living in a middle-class suburban tract house, going to work every day, watching out over two other children, and trying to separate what I was seeing about Nancy and ourselves in the paper from our life. It truly was a nightmare, and yet a nightmare where you certainly could not see what the end would be.
You met Sid Vicious for the first time when Nancy came back with him to Huntington, and they got off the train, and would you describe for us the way they looked that
yes,
day?
Yes, I could. If I were a painter, which I'm not, I guess I can only paint with words, I could truly paint that picture. Nancy and Sid came to Philadelphia in August of 1978. We had not seen Nancy for a year and a half. And this is, you know, where the story, I guess, there's a divergence from what the press tried to say. She was middle class, and she brought him home to her family and to see her home. And there wasn't particularly something she was rebelling against. And my husband and I went to the Trenton Railroad Station. And you have to picture a hot summer Friday afternoon. All the commuters are coming back from New York. And the station is crowded, and people are pushing to get on their way. And we were rather nervous. I know I had a knot in my stomach, and I wondered if I would know Nancy. And suddenly I heard this scream, and it was, "Mom!" Nancy seems always to have picked up her English accent or whatever accent, depending on who she was with. And I looked, and there was a face. It was, to me, it was like chiaroscuro, black and white. They just stood out from everybody on the platform. And Nancy's hair was pure white, the blonde, but to white. And her skin was that white color that you see in perhaps people that are about to die, that kind of translucent pallor. And there were small bruises, and she was dressed in clothing that I was totally unfamiliar with. And Sid was kind of hiding, almost lurking shyly behind her. And he looked very similar, except his hair was darker. But this pallor about them, and everyone in the train station on the platform had just stopped, and they were gaping at them, and they seemed, Sid and Nancy seemed to have no knowledge that anyone was looking at them or that they looked any differently than anybody else on the platform. And Nancy ran over and she hugged me. That was one of the few times she put her arms around me. She goes, my mom, my beautiful mom, I'm here. And she introduced me to Sid, and he kind of hung his head, and then he shook my hand, and he shook my husband's hand. But it was a very emotional, traumatic moment, because this was not the Nancy that I even knew a year and a half ago. I just kept thinking to myself, where's my baby? You know, I want her back. Who is this stranger? And it was a real difficult time.
What do you think of the name Vicious? Was that supposed to be an ironic joke, or did that really describe his temperament?
I'm not quite sure. As far as the Sid that we knew, and I can only talk from that experience, he was very placid, very quiet, almost, he communicated very little, and he was polite, although much of his language was punctuated by cursing, but that seems to be just part of the way he spoke. And I had remarked to my husband that he certainly was a lot easier to handle than Nancy was. I mean, you kind of could predict what he was going to do. And if you didn't want to do one thing and you wanted to do something else, that was perfectly all right with him. So I guess as far as we were concerned, the name was a misnomer.
She used to cut his meat for him at the dinner table. What do you think?
I think that they had a... People have asked me, did they love each other? And I can only say what I observed, and I guess it's not the kind of love perhaps that you and I know, but there was kind of almost a symbiotic relationship. She took care of him. She was, in a way, his mother. Nancy was, by all reports, and we certainly know that, extremely bright. And Sid had not had that much education, and he had a special sensitivity, I guess, but he needed to be taken care of. And so she took care of him, but sometimes she needed to be taken care of, and it appears that in those areas, he took care of her.
Do you have any idea how he got into punk rock?
It was my understanding. I did a little bit of research when I went to write the book that they had another guitarist who had gotten sick or who wanted to leave for some reason, and he kind of was perhaps a groupie to the Sex Pistols, and he hung around the shop in London where they bought their clothes and where the manager, I believe McLaren, and he happened to be there at the right time or the wrong time, I guess, and they took him in the group. I don't think he was a musician per se, but he fit the image of the group at the time.
You said before that you didn't think that your daughter was rebelling against a middle-class background. You think she just wanted something different for herself?
Yes, I think it was the next wave of music. And to that, it intrigued her. And certainly the fact that there seems to be at least an aura of violence around punk rock, particularly in England, that did not frighten her, nor was she uncomfortable with it. I don't think that she had any deep philosophical feelings about punk rock, nor in the brief conversations I had with Sid, did we ever get that that's what he found in it either. It was a way to make some money. It was a way to be famous. And I think, at least for Nancy, I think that that was the, you know, it was kind of like she was the moth drawn to the flame. And for now, it was this type of music that was the flame.
In England, especially, punk came out of a very working class kind of background. Do you think that she was at all embarrassed by being from a good middle class upbringing, so to speak, you know, or maybe even at this point upper middle class? Was that something she'd try to cover up?
No, I don't think so. It seems that I met people who said she had talked about me, and she always talked about her family, and yet she carried pictures of the family and our cats with her, and even a visit. Her grandmother used to live in St. Thomas, and we'd visit a beautiful house. And all these pictures she carried through England with her and showed everybody her family. So, no, I don't think it embarrassed her at all. I don't think that at this point Nancy thought about it on a cerebral level.
A lot of times parents feel, and it's not as extreme as this, that they don't understand who their children have become. They don't understand the clothes they're wearing or their hair or their friends or the way they speak, their interests. And then there's, like, the family encounter in which you sit down and you try to talk it through. Did you ever go through that kind of thing with Nancy? Was it beyond that?
It was absolutely beyond that, even from, let's say, 12 or 13. But I think I did understand, and did the rest of our family, what Nancy was about. Because, like I said, it was just an extension of what she was as a child. I remember at 10, she was like a miniature hippie. And she was always seemed somehow 10 years ahead of her time.
You had some really difficult decisions to make, because there were times when they were in London and when they were in New York, when one of them would call you up and say, oh, we need money desperately. And you'd suspect that it was for drugs, and you had a plan that if you were going to help them out with money, you'd send it directly to the landlord or to the doctor so you'd get the bills taken care of. But you wanted to make sure that you weren't participating and supporting their habit. How did you figure out, how did you get secure in knowing that you were, that they wanted it for the drugs, or that if, you know, when to break your own rule and actually send them money directly? Because it's such a difficult thing to figure out when you're hundreds or thousands of miles away.
I had looked for some support, for some advice in this matter. And, of course, the professionals say, well, don't send her money. But that's very easy to say and not very easy to do. If it was a specific thing, such as she was ill, I would send it to the doctor, or in New York, I would send it directly to the landlord. Then I was comfortable. But by then, I had really learned to follow my intuition, my gut feeling. If she called, I remember one particular horrible call from England. She said, it's before Sid, I think. Mommy, I'm living in a car. I have no food. I have nothing to eat. I thought about it. It's my child. And if I sent her $50, that she certainly couldn't buy very much drugs with it. And maybe she did need food, or maybe she did need a place to stay. And if that was my gut feeling, then I followed it.
What was their last conversation with her like?
Nancy had called me on the Sunday before she died in October, just a little over 5 years ago. She was in New York by then with Sid. It was after the famous visit at our house. She seemed quite different. I know she was on methadone. What else she was taking, I don't know, but I'm sure she was taking other types of drugs. But she was very clear. And it was the first conversation, I think, that we'd had in 3, maybe 4 years, in which there was actual communication. She heard me. She listened. She responded. And it was kind of, you'd say it was a rather chilling call. She went through a number of things. One, she asked me to find out about a particular drug rehab center that a neighbor of ours had gone to. She said that she and Sid would like to go. They both needed to get off drugs. She said she was as low as she could get. And I said, Nancy, I've always told you that I am here for you if that ever happens. She said, I think soon you're going to find me on your doorstep. And she had mentioned something about the fact that Sid was very upset and that he had been hitting her. And this upset me very much, but I wasn't quite sure how much truth there was in it. And indeed, if there was, what could I do about it? She specifically asked for her father and her grandmother, with whom she had not, by her own choice, had much communication over the last few years. And she specifically expressed her love for them and asked me to deliver these words to her grandmother and to her father. And when we finished the phone call, I had already put the phone down, or was in the act of doing so, when I heard her yell, I love you, Mommy. And these were the last words I ever heard from her. When I hung up the phone, my husband was standing right there, and I did not say this now. I don't say this now in hindsight, but at that time, I said that was a very scary phone call. It was as if she were saying goodbye to everybody, and indeed, that's what she was doing.
She died just a few days later.
Yes, that was a Sunday, and she died on Thursday morning.
She was found under a sink in the bathroom with, a 7-inch blade through her chest.
No, it was in her stomach.
And she bled to death on the floor. What's your theory? I mean, it's been said that Vicious probably killed her. What's your theory of what happened?
Of course, he never was tried, so, you know, we can't say with certainty. However, I think that Nancy knew that she was doomed, as we did. I think that other last conversation in the car was we drove her back to the Trenton Railroad Station pretty much explained that. She said, I'm 80 years old and I'm going to die soon. I told you I will never live to my 21st birthday. And she had been saying this for a number of years. So I think that it was indeed her intention to die. She had tried suicide twice. She certainly had tried suicide in the form of drug abuse. And somehow she couldn't do it, or it didn't seem to work. And I think that although she was violent, more inner-directed than any other way, Sid was more outwardly violent, and I think she really made him a victim. And Nancy certainly, at her bad moments, could make you angry enough that you'd want to hit her or, you know, do something just to stop her. And I think that perhaps she egged him on. In a way, it was a form of suicide, or that she certainly engineered her own death. She bought him the knife. I mean, this is just my theory. And knowing Nancy, though, I really think that, especially based on the last conversation, that she just somehow felt it was over.
Sid Vicious sent you a couple of letters. Can you describe them, the letters you got after her death?
Yes, they were letters that were extremely emotional and sensitive. Perhaps did not seem that they would come from Sid. And yet, I do believe the English in their education do learn to put things down in writing much better than we do here. And at first I doubted almost that he had written the letters, but there are certain very personal, private things in there that led me to believe no one else could have written them. And the letters were very touching. He talked about how much he deeply, really loved her. And I did not find them threatening in the sense that he in any way threatened me, but he put a responsibility on me by saying that only I understood and that he loved me. And I found that a very terrible responsibility to bear because I was not emotionally, at that time was a month, less than a month after Nancy's death, I felt myself feeling for him, but I felt that I could not take on the responsibility of his life also.
It would have been easier to hate him?
It would have been, but I couldn't. I felt that he should be, if he had murdered her, that he certainly should be punished for it, but I just could not feel any real hate for him.
The title of your book comes from one of his letters, doesn't it?
Yes, he had written a little poem about himself and about Nancy, and the "And I Don't Want to Live This Life" title is a statement that he made, that he no longer wanted to live this life. But I think it applies to Nancy and perhaps applied to all of us, as I guess sometimes it applies to any of us, that sometimes we're in a situation we don't want to be in.
You think he killed himself because he really couldn't live without her?
It seemed from the letters that that's what his intention was, and yet the circumstances around his death are somewhat questionable. But based on his letters, he said, if I am ever dead, you will know that, you know, if I'm found dead under any circumstances, that I truly killed myself. So I would tend to believe that, you know, he carried out what he said in his letters.
You were afraid that at the trial, at his trial, that somehow it would be Nancy who was really on trial. Why did you think that would happen?
Oh, I have no question now, that based on knowledge that I have accumulated over the last 5 years, that it would have been Nancy that was on trial. At many trials, the victim somehow, much as the rape victim has been accused in the past, they somehow have, the feeling comes across by the defense attorneys that this person has somehow done something to cause their own death, and therefore it's excusable for the defendant to have done such an act. And Nancy, with the background that she had, there's no question that that would have been brought out, and Nancy would have been, in fact, killed again by the defense attorneys.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Deborah Spungen, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, "And I Don't Want to Live This Life Anymore." And it's an autobiographical book about her life and her family and her daughter, Nancy Spungen, who was found dead in
78.
You got a really strange call from Sid Vicious's mother afterwards asking if he could be buried alongside your daughter, and she was buried in a family plot. How did you handle that phone call?
I must admit to having been extremely upset. It was certainly nothing that I expected, and I thought that first Nancy's death and now Sid was dead, that it was truly over, and I had a great deal of trouble dealing with it. I just knew that he couldn't be buried there just by sheer virtue of the fact there were X number of places in the plot. And I told her this, but she didn't seem to want to accept it. And I felt once more this family is putting a responsibility on me that I didn't want and I really at the time could not cope with.
It's a strange request to put on a family that they bury the person in the family plot who probably killed their daughter.
I kept thinking, it's kind of knowing Nancy, that if there's a life after death, that I kept thinking that what Nancy is doing to Sid, he did not need to be buried next to her, that she, if there was some other world out there, that knowing Nancy, she wasn't going to give him much peace anyway.
This is where the press really starts to come in at your house. Who showed up after the after the murder? What magazines and newspapers were represented in the pack of journalists?
Well, it was a great deal. First of all, the local press in Philadelphia came. However, when we continued, as the rest of the family did, to say no comment, they backed off in the sense that they didn't badger us anymore, but they just went ahead and wrote or created their own interpretation or their own story. A lot of the other journalists were the English press, and some of the press from New York, particularly I think it was the New York Post, and some of the others. And they virtually camped out in front of our house. Several times I had to call the police because they wouldn't get off of the property. And although they're allowed to ring the doorbell, they're supposed to leave. One day I came home from work and there was, and I can't actually remember who it was. I believe it was the English press was hiding in the bushes as I approached my house, and a couple of national magazines as well. One particular, it was a stringer from a national magazine, tried to bully his way in. And he did this by saying, first of all, he got past a friend who let them in. And then he said, I'm going to write this story anyway, and you're not going to like it. So if you give me the story, it will be right. And of course, this was exactly one day after her funeral. And you're just not thinking clearly. And unfortunately, well, we gave them the story, but fortunately it was never published. And we were very sorry that we did that. And I think I still have difficulty understanding how certain members of the press can come up to you at the time of the death, particularly a violent death of someone, a child, and thrust a mic in your face and ask you, really, how do you feel about your child's murderer? How do you feel about your child's murderer? I still find that ethically difficult to assimilate.
What's the story that was told in the press when you look back at the coverage as a whole?
It was a story. I think it had all the right components, I guess, to sell papers or make people listen to TV. I think there's this saying, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I guess it put it together. They kind of likened Nancy and Sid to a Romeo and Juliet. And I don't, that was the story. There was no attempt at all to give Nancy any dignity. I mean, I understand what she was, but she was still a human being and she still did not deserve to be murdered in such a fashion. And the story was exploited and sensationalized till I think when I looked at the stories, I began to wonder who was the victim and who was the murderer.
When you got more experienced with dealing with the press, what did you do?
I decided from then on, for the next few months anyway, at least really until I've gotten involved on the other side of it, to say no comment and just turn it off. It still hurts when you see, let's say, a Saturday Night Live doing a skit called Nauseating Nancy or seeing the word Nauseating Nancy across the cover of New York Magazine. But it hurts. But you just, I decided for 2 years to completely not have anything to do with the press. And it took me a long time and a friendship with the Philadelphia Inquirer reporter to understand and to perhaps be able to have some kind of relationship with the press.
Well, now you've written a book about it and are doing interviews about the subject. Do you feel any differently having, like, written the story and, doing interviews now? Is that, like, demarcating a period of your life?
Oh, absolutely. But you mean in reference to the press? I still feel, I think last week I did an Inquirer article, and he said I was rather edgy. He said I was quoting the interview that I was edgy. And I guess I still am because it still reminds me of the time of Nancy's death. I'm not anymore in an adversary position, and I'm getting my opportunity to tell the real story. But I still have some difficulty because it comes from such a painful time and a time when I thought we were treated unfairly.
I think writing about something is supposed to help you get over it or reconcile what's happened. Do you find that that's been true for you?
Absolutely, although it took a long time. The actual writing of the book was 16 months, and it's been almost a year since its completion. And I find now that most of my pain is really between the covers now and that there is much more of a feeling of peace and the ability to, I guess, to accept what was and not to really dwell on what might have been and to now not be obsessed by it, but to go forward.
You've used the expression in this interview that it was over, what do you mean by that?
I think Nancy's life being over. I think it was such a painful odyssey for all of us, but it took Nancy's death to let me understand how much worse her pain was than any of ours. And for her, it was over. For us, it was not. But we're all okay, and we can endure and survive. But I know that she is truly at peace now. And that, for us, is very important. And so that's what I'm really... There's a closure now, a completion. That part of our life is over.
How did the family's relationship to each other changed after Nancy's death, since... so much of the family revolved around concern for her and, you know, trying to protect her, bail her out from different problems.
I think my son was quoted in the book as saying, quoted him as saying, it was all of, he said, it was the four of us on the outside and Nancy in the middle. And it took us a long time to become, I guess, a family of four. Nancy is still a part, is it still in our family? We all think of her, but we needed to learn to function as a different kind of unit. And it took a lot of work on each of our parts and a lot of love and a lot of commitment and some outside help and support. And I guess it was about 2 years when we turned the corner. We all learned to communicate in that we had gotten so used to talking in triangles because nobody wanted to confront anybody else with things. And again, nobody wanted to see the other person's pain. And we wanted to protect each other. But on the other hand, we all had to deal with our own pain. And I think we have survived. And we are a stronger family unit. Although the children are now 24 and 22, older than Nancy ever was, we still have a need to be together, to grab a couple hours of lunch here or there on the run, to spend time together. And I think that the children, as a result, have come out of it. In many ways, they're much more mature because they've experienced part of life that usually, or unfortunately, you don't have to experience perhaps until you're older. I think they're more sensitive, they're more compassionate. And I think they've been to the other side and they have a better feeling, as we do, of what is important in life.
There's something I really don't hear you doing, and that is like blaming punk rock or blaming drugs for Nancy's problems during her life.
No, I think those areas were really secondary to Nancy's true problems. And I think in many cases, children who have serious problems will get involved, be it drug or whatever. And so my anger, certainly, you are, you know, correct. I don't blame that for Nancy's problems.
You've founded a group in Philadelphia that's a local chapter of a national group called Parents of Murdered Children. At what point did you want to become active in a group like that?
I think initially I didn't ever thought I'd never want to become active in anything. I wanted to do things and not let anyone know I had been doing them. And yet, as the first year went by and into the second year, I had this real need to talk to another mother. I just had to find a mother that had survived the murder of their child and the ordeal and see them. I just wanted to see they were whole and intact. And I called a self-help group that dealt with children who have just died, whether it be illness or accident, and they didn't seem to understand. They told me the bottom line was that my child was dead and how they died meant nothing. And I didn't buy that at all. And one day I was watching television, and I happened to see on a talk show that there were four parents, sets of parents, whose children had been murdered, had founded local chapters of an organization called Parents of Murdered Children. I contacted them, and just sharing and talking on the phone was a great help. But I wanted to go to a meeting, and there was no Philadelphia chapter. And I was not, at the time, the least interested in starting the chapter. But as the months went by and nobody else came forward, I suddenly realized, as did my husband, that it was incumbent upon us to start it. Somebody had to go do it, and might as well be us. And so that's how it came to be. And it wasn't an easy decision, and nor was going to the first meeting very easy.
What have you learned from being active in the group?
Oh, I've learned an awful lot. They're like another family for me. I've learned that, number one, that the Spungen family absolutely had no corner on pain and suffering. I was sure we had suffered more than anybody else, and it just took one meeting for me to understand that was not true. It has also increased my compassion. I feel for other people's pain, which I didn't before. In addition, it's really gotten me to see that anger is okay, but it can be inappropriate. And when you take anger, because anger is a force, and make action out of it, and you can do other things with it that are therapeutic, the effect is therapeutic, the intention is not. And you can really accomplish an awful lot on the strength of that anger.
Is it constantly reopening wounds for you to be involved with parents whose child was just murdered?
It hurts when you see their pain, but I don't really think it reopens the wound, maybe for a slight moment. I always find when I come out of the meeting, I have to go eat pasta because it's so nurturing. I need to come back, be put back together again. I think it's just that you can share it with them. And by taking some of their pain, perhaps from them, it hurts you too. But it's such a safe place to be. I think that's what's so important and beautiful about it. There's no other place, I think, on earth that I can sit and hear other parents say what they say, and I can say the things that I say. And I think it also, even though it hurts, it's a reaffirmation of life. It's really not a grieving club. I think that's what makes it okay. People don't go there just to cry, but it is okay to cry. But you can laugh, and you can, I mean, I meet a mother. I mean, I was in Pittsburgh, and I did a TV show, and there was the Parents of Murdered Children chapter leader. And you just go over and kiss and put your arms around each other because there's something very special that we all share.
You're active also in victims' rights work. What are the issues that you think need to be addressed in victims' rights?
I think the most important issue today is the fact that I think people have to become aware that the victim has no rights and that until a person does become a victim, they don't think about it. I think with the level of crime in this country, that the pendulum has swung so far the other way that people have forgotten that the victim exists. I think that the victim needs to be protected, as does the defendant, by laws. And some of the laws would be simply a victim's bill of rights, spelling out what their rights are. I think a victim should be compensated, whether it be murder or robbery or rape. And I think that it should be much like workman's compensation. We do have a compensation law in the state of Pennsylvania, but right now certain legislators, such as Representative Sweet, are working to upgrade that law so that victims can be compensated for more than just loss of, let's say, salary, or for, but in addition, perhaps pain and suffering and psychological counseling.
When someone isn't around to speak for themselves, it's easy to wonder, like, would they have wanted me to write this book? Would they have wanted me to grieve them in the way I'm going to do it? But you saw things so differently than your daughter did. Did you ask yourself that? Because, I mean, there were so few things that you probably agreed on about how life should be lived anyways.
I thought about that. I think that perhaps our basic philosophies in life were different, but I always loved her, and I still do. And the last thing she ever said to me was, "Mommy, I love you." And I think that's the bottom line. That was the communication between us that never went away. And I think whether Nancy's not here, and one can't really say, and whether she wanted me to or not, I still would have written it. But I think we've talked about it, my husband and I, and we've thought about it. And I really think Nancy would approve. I think Nancy also had something to say. She just didn't know how to say it correctly or to get the message across. And so I've done that for her. And by doing so, I've said goodbye to her.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.